This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
So I'm staying in my armchair. Go on without me if you must. So many shows on Netflix. And even more on Hulu Plus. Nonstop solid entertainment. Till my body turns to dust.
TV is awesome!
Here are your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to episode 24 of TV Good, Sleep Bad. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones, and joining me of course is my co-host and partner in crime, Mr. Daniel Lackey. But of course, I mean, if you're tuning in for the first time, we are of course now on the ThatMomentIn.com podcast network. This of course being our first official show here on the network, and I have to say I'm excited to be here expanding and perhaps in some ways bringing down the tone of the network that we're now a part of.
I would say, I hope we class up the place a little bit as opposed to maybe, you know, tarnish it.
Yeah. It's all like they built it this good name and then we just like somehow snuck and in.
And then they said, hey, you two ruffians, what do you think?
It's all like,
You two riffraff, what do you think? We're going to join our podcasting group. What, but of course.
Yeah. It's sort of like, things are going so well. How can we mess this up?
How can we mess this up? Here's an episode about Sapphire and Steel.
So, I mean, we're obviously now at the start of a new year here in 2018, and we've just recently had the Christmas break, and for ourselves, I mean, we obviously watched Pee-wee Herman's Christmas special, we watched Community, and now we're obviously into like a new season, and it seems that now the TV gods have actually decided to just suddenly bring back all the shows I like and have everything on at the same time. So it's just an absolute scheduling nightmare. But I mean, what's been holding your interest so far, like a few weeks into the new year?
What have I been watching? You see, I have a Thursday night TV night with a friend of mine, and we're the new season of Black Mirror dropped, and I think I'm the only person in North America who isn't caught up with everything because I've been waiting. My friend didn't show up for a couple of weeks. I've been waiting for her, so I'm only on episode. We just finished episode 2 last night.
Okay.
And we're doing a couple of legacy shows as well. We're doing Sherlock and Person of Interest. I have not been watching a whole lot other than that. Longtime listeners will remember that this is kind of the lead up to my TV watching season. It really begins in like February or March when Better Call Saul and the Americans come back. So it's going to be kind of light. I don't think we have dates on those two yet. And with Doctor Who, with the new showrunner, Doctor Who is going to be starting in the fall this year instead of the spring. We're not going to get a season of Game of Thrones this year, which apparently Game of Thrones fans don't know how to cope with it when a show hasn't been on for a year. I said, well, you try waiting 17 years for a new episode season of Doctor Who and see where that gets you. There's a couple of things I still need to. I want to get back to Glitch, that Australian kind of but not really zombie show. The other thing I just started, it looks like it's going to be really interesting, is the second season of Ryan Murphy's American Crime Story, which 2 years ago. 2 years ago, they did the People versus O.J. Simpson, and this year the story is the assassination of Gianni Versace.
Okay.
With Edgar Ramirez as Gianni Versace and Penelope Cruz as Donatella Versace. And the second episode is aired. I haven't watched that yet. I watched the first episode, and it was pretty good. And of course, the season 11 of the X-Files is going over here. and well, this week was the week that this week's episode was called The Lost Art of Forehead Sweat. And since it had more than two words in the title, you know that that was this year's Darren Morgan episode. It was absolute fried gold, as all of Darren Morgan's. I don't think the guy is really capable of putting out a bad episode of the X-Files. And if even as uneven as season 10 was, and this reboot has been, the new season has been a little bit better. We're almost halfway into it, but as kind of dodgy as it can be, as far as I'm concerned, 5 years ago, I would have said that one of the great cultural tragedies was we only ever had four episodes of The X-Files written by Darren Morgan, and those four episodes are all four of them are amongst the best episodes of the show. So to bring back, I will take a season of nine crappy X-Files episodes if it gives me a good Darren Morgan episode, because he can his perspective, really, he's got this really interesting perspective, and his episodes they're always the silly or the funny ones, but they always kind of have that sort of Philip K. Dickian thing that really make you think. That's what's been holding my interest lately. What about you?
Okay. Well, I mean, X-Files isn't actually being aired over here till February, because Channel 5 got the UK rights, and Channel 5 seemed to be under the delusion that we're somehow still in the 90s, and that if you don't show something the day after the estates, that people aren't going to pirate it.
Right.
I've seen the trailer for it, and I have to say the trailer looked absolutely insane. And I've heard that My Struggle Part 3 was a step too far for the show. to put it politely.
Oh, boy, yeah. I will say this about My Struggle 3. I will give Chris Carter props, because he came up with the idea of the X-Files. And some of the really good episodes he did write some of the really good episodes. Not all of his episodes were great. But kind of the thing is that it's more and more as we get into this mythology. And, you know, when I was a kid, I watched the X-Files when I was in my 20s. And back then, I was really mad about conspiracy theories. And I collected conspiracies. I didn't believe in them, but I found them fascinating. And, you know, things like alien invasions and government conspiracies and all that stuff. And I always looked at the standalone episodes as being kind of like the price I had to pay for getting, mythology episode. And now that I'm older, I look at the mythology episodes as the price I have to pay to get a Darren Morgan episode. It's like, yeah, My Struggle Part 3 stank.
Okay.
To be quite honest, and there's some things in there that I'm not going to spoil that don't, and quite rightly, do not sit very well with the fandom.
Yeah.
But I shouldn't say it didn't completely stink. I like the new recurring villain of the season, played by Barbara Hershey. I really wish they'd put the smoking man to bed. I mean, he's just come back too many times, but on the one hand, but on the other hand, William B. Davis is just such a delightful actor to watch.
Yeah.
That you can kind of forget. I mean, he shows up for like 30 seconds in the Adam Wingard Death Note movie. He shows up for like 30 seconds as like an Alex Jones style radio conspiracy theorist. And it's like, it's the smoking man. But it's like, and you know, the two, the fake Mulder and fake Scully, we're in it for like 2 minutes, and it's like, do we even, Chris Carter, why do you even think we care about those two?
Yeah.
You know? But it's like, this is likely to be the final season because Jillian has said she is not coming back, and Chris has said he doesn't want to do it without Scully.
Yeah.
So.
Well, at the end of My Struggle 3, there is a hidden bit of dialogue, which is Chris Carter giving thanks to the fans, and actually saying that if this is the end, thank you for the journey. I was the opposite of yourself. I didn't really care for the mythology. I think the mythology kind of had an ending, I think it was around season 6, where the main conspiracy players all got set on fire. Mm-hmm. And then it was sort of like, oh no, wait, we're going to continue it again. It's sort of like, no, you had an ending. Why are you trying to tack stuff onto it? William B. Davis, though, it's really funny when you look at his career, because before The X-Files, he was like, always like the warm grandfatherly figure, and The X-Files sort of gave him a chance to play this darker character. And I mean, he was originally just some bit player that they brought in. He was just going to be the guy who smokes in the background, and then they were so intrigued by his performance that they actually built more around it.
Right.
But I mean, speaking of secret messages, I found out as well, at the end of every It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, we have the little logo, and you have like the backwards dialogue.
For the McKelney, Charlie Day, Glenn Howard and production company, they have the backwards mass dialogue.
Yeah, yeah. If you play it forward, it says you're stupid for playing this forward.
They change it every season.
Okay.
They change it every season, and that was one of the ones that they did.
I mean, other than obviously missing the X-Files, I will probably have my own thoughts when we do the next episode. Netflix, they've just added the end of the fucking world.
Yeah, we just got that over here as well.
Yeah.
And a couple people have watched it so far, and I'm hearing some interesting things about it. It's definitely piqued my interest.
Yeah, I mean, it came out over here in the UK. It came out, and they made a big fanfare about it on Channel 4. I mean, they did it as like one of their box sets. So they played the first episode, and you could watch the whole box set straight after. And now it's been picked up by Netflix, which I think is really great because it means that more people are probably going to see it. And basically, it follows this 17-year-old called James, who also believes he's a psychopath. And he ends up on this bizarre-ass road trip with this girl called Alyssa, who's got her own issues, to say the least. And basically, they're going across this road trip across Britain to meet with Alyssa's father. And along the way, they sort of discover more about themselves and discover this connection between them as they find themselves on this bizarre crime spree, and they become these like Bonnie and Clyde-esque figures completely by accident. This is a show which is really quite refreshing. I mean, it's short like an American show. In particular, the pilot episode is shot with very much like all these elements of Wes Anderson, certainly like the framing. When James like talks about his victims, and you have like this screenshot, and it's like his collection of like dead animals that he's killed. But they, for some reason, for like episode 2, they scrap all that, and it's kind of like in 6 Feet Under when they had the fake adverts, and then they suddenly scrapped them and didn't do them in any other episode. It's kind of jarring, the sudden shift, but it's a really fun little short series. I mean, you can pretty much binge watch it in a day, I would say. I mean, it's only about 6 or 8 episodes and about 30 minutes apiece. But it's, as I said, it's a really great self-contained little show. But at the same time, being on Netflix, I keep hearing threats that they're going to do a second series, and I'm not sure how, because it's so self-contained. It has an ending. And I think if you try to expand it, it is going to only make it worse. But I would say it's definitely one worth discovering. I mean, it's based on the graphic novel the same name by Charles S. Forsman, but I personally couldn't get into the graphic novel because I'm kind of an art snob when it comes to my graphic novels, and the art just wasn't doing it for me. But the show itself is great. I'd recommend checking it out, especially if you've got a Netflix account.
Cool. Yeah. No, it's like I said, it's I've heard a couple of people. It's starting to kind of get some cult buzz over here.
Rewatch side of things. I've also been rewatching Girls, Lena Dunham's sort of breakout series as such. I think if you're kind of, I think it really, your enjoyment of the show really depends on if you like mumblecore or not. I mean, lucky you are a fan of mumblecore or
no.
You're a hipster.
No, God, no. Yeah, all that Joe Swanberg type stuff, it's kind of funny because I really, when Adam Wingard actually kind of started out and Ty West kind of started out in that scene, I just realized recently that, I didn't realize this before, but Lena Dunham and Greta Gerwig both have minor roles in House of the Devil. Lena Dunham is the 911 operator.
Okay.
Like the first couple of Adam Wingard's films, I absolutely hated. And it kind of like tainted like that name, the Adam Wingard name, until he actually like started like turning up the levels on his microphone sound equipment. And he started getting Simon Barrett scripts. Yeah. Because once he did, I hated Terrible Way to Die. I hated that one. I hated Pop Skull. And then it was like, oh, God, I have to see You're Next. Oh, this one's actually good. Oh, The Guest is actually kind of great. You know, but no, I don't. And a lot of it is, and this is probably unfair, a lot of it is that Lena Dunham, her personality,
yeah,
really kind of her public image really kind of turns me off. And I was really kind of irritated with the hype that surrounded Girls when it was first on, the first couple seasons, or really the first season. You know, it's just that these sort of New York privileged white hipsters talking, basically kind of living this life and not realizing that there's an entire world out there that isn't Brooklyn, that really doesn't really appeal to me. And I know they've had some, and I'm probably being unfair, and I know they've had some, really good, I know that they've had some really, I mean, that's where Adam Driver really made his name, was on that show. And I know like Chris O'Dowd was on it. Donald Glover was on it. But it's just like, everything I know about it just turns me off. It's not something, I'm not necessarily trying to prejudge it and say it's bad before I've even seen it, but just knowing what I know about it, it's not the sort of thing I would really respond well to.
Oh, I totally understand what you're saying. I think Lena Dunham's a prime example of how not to do your career. I mean, say the first two seasons were actually incredible, but after that it was kind of like a law of diminishing returns, as you could tell that her writing power had very much run out. Dunham herself, I mean, I remember still, when I saw Girls Season 1, and I remember touting her as being this over-exciting voice, this really original voice, and then you realize, as you said, she's just a privileged white kid who thinks that every random thought that tumbles out of her head is absolutely fascinating and wonderful. And it really isn't. And it really, the other thing than this, I mean, this is going to sound really petty, but the fact that you break your back to really sell and push someone's, put someone out there and get behind someone, and then they basically say, no, I don't care about all the independent and the bloggers who put my stuff out there. Because I'm now popular with Cosmopolitan and Marie Claire and all these mainstream people, I'm just going to go and give, like, the premiere episodes to them and fuck everyone who helped me get to the top. And, I did not take that well. And then, obviously, a book came out and she's there making rape accusations. And then acting really blasé about it and wondering why people are pissed about that. Because, you know, you can't just go around accusing people of rape. It's not...
And it's just like some of the things she would put in that book, it was like, it's like she has absolutely no self-awareness whatsoever.
No.
You know, it's like, now, I mean, she put this, you've probably heard the stories about her sister in the rocks.
And, I've heard of my wife. It's
now kind of opened her up to, she now basically, it's this sort of thing now where basically she really can't say anything about, you know, make rape happen, or say really anything about rape culture, because somebody's always going to say, but he sexually molested her sister.
Yeah.
And it's like, she just is weird, and she was experimenting, and yeah, that's kind of weird, but the whole point of the whole thing is that why do you even put – why is it even something you feel is worth sharing? You know? Exactly. It's like not every little anecdote from your childhood is worth sharing. You know, I guess it's the whole thing. It's just like a whole oversharing thing. And I know – I mean, that's part of my problem with the sort of certain segment of celebrities now, is that I have been completely unable to avoid knowing more about them than I want to know. You know, I don't need to know – I don't need to know about what Lena Dunham and her sister got up to, you know, at such a time. I don't need to know this stuff.
Yeah.
I don't want to know.
I mean, it's very much, I mean, these are exactly the reasons why, as I said, I've gone back to my gloom. I mean, I no longer have the time nor the patience to be dealing with the egos of the mainstream.
And, right.
I mean, this is the thing. I didn't know I could be bored by nudity until Dunham came along.
I've been bored by nudity for years.
And it's sort of like, but when did first, when, again, this is an example. I mean, Dunham's not your traditional attractive lead. She's an average looking girl. But, right. And at the same time, she's there and she's getting naked. And, you know, this is an average looking girl getting naked. This is interesting. Now, when she's doing it all the time, it's sort of like, yeah, she's naked, but really, who gives a crap anymore? It's so like, I am bored of seeing you naked.
One of my things is never, ever, always question the motives of people who write themselves nude scenes. You know, it's and I don't care about gender. I say, you know, always question Jason Segel's motives. Question them as equally as you question Lena Dunham's. Yeah. It's not a gender thing.
I'm about to say, that's how we normally... That's how we fund the show, by friends, to get naked, so...
Yeah, it's...
The more you pay, the more we wear.
Yeah, there you go. It's the first Kickstarter where the stretch goals of I'll put clothes on instead of I'll take clothes off for the stretch goals.
This is our thing. We're furthering our career as troll strippers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not gonna tell her. I'll make the snarky remark. I'll make the snarky remark about never trust the motives of anybody who writes their own nude scenes. Yeah, I mean, good on her for going up there and having that confidence or whatever. You know, good on her for showing, demonstrating that there are more, you know, body types in the world than, you know, the tall emaciated supermodel and the, you know, the busty supermodel type.
Yeah.
You know, but it's, you know, it just struck me that you know, she just basically started believing her own hype too much.
Well, I mean, I can't wait until we get into the same situation we are with now with, like, Netflix, Queer as Folk, Friends, Saved by the Bell, where the shows we came up through in the 90s, the millennials are now watching them and are horrified by some of the things that are in there, such as on Sex and the City, that Carrie has a bi boyfriend, which, of course, is just a stopover. It's just a phase, and... Samantha having a black boyfriend is a fetishist fantasy. What else was there? Oh, we've got Zach dressing up as a Native American Indian. We've got, in Queer as Folk, we've got the 29-year-old lead who's having sex with a 15-year-old, and it's made jokes of.
Hey, you can still do that. You can still do that. Look at all the critical acclaim and popular acclaim "Call Me by Your Name" is getting. Brolyta. Oh my god, that's a really good name for it. Mind you, it is a really good movie.
I've yet to see it, but
it's It's actually a really good movie. I don't like it as much as everybody else does, but you know, I'm pro Armie Hammer, and he dances to Love My Way, and it's got, you know, Michael Stuhlbarg is in it, and he gets three good scenes, and the kid's fine, and there's a lot of pretty northern Italian stuff to look at. It's the guy who's directing the Suspiria remake.
Okay.
And basically based on like the sort of almost, it's almost kind of like this dreamlike quality that the film has, that it's almost like the days are impossibly long in this film. And it's like, oh, this guy's going to do wonders. This guy's going to do wonders with Suspiria.
Well,
but yeah.
I mean, Bret Easton Ellis has like proclaimed it one of his favorite films of the year.
Okay, I hate it now.
Seeing how Bret Easton Ellis spends every podcast going on about how he has a younger boyfriend makes me a little surprised that he hasn't seen it. And at the same time, I mean, Moonlight wins the Best Picture. A whole film you have to go through just to watch another man kiss another man. And I mean, I don't know if it's because I came up through like Greg Araki movies, but how I like to see homosexuality played on film, it's just very rough and ready, and it's still very out there, and you know, we're embracing what we are. It's not, oh, let's just faff around and maybe we'll get to see two guys make out by the end of this film. It's sort of like, no, we're here and we're gonna be super proud of it.
You know, it's I'm not the world's biggest Greg Araki fan, but then I will say that the guy was doing stuff in Doom Generation,
yeah,
that mainstream filmmakers will clutch their pearls today.
I think with Greg Araki, he's a zenial director. I think that's the thing. He's very much embodies that 90s post-MTV wasteland style. And that's why I gravitate towards him and why I like Ben Folds and Fiona Apple. It's
right.
All part of this sort of era that I obviously came up in, a zenial. I mean, between you Gen Xers and God forbid millennials, it's this like time where we got new technology coming in and we're learning how to embrace it, and at the same time we're throwing ideas out there which are risque and we shouldn't be talking about. So we got things like Larry Clark's Kids, and I think that's why, because I mean I love Larry Clark as well, and I think Greg Araki is just sort of like on the same sort of wavelength, really. That's why I always loved his films. So,
and again, I wouldn't call myself a fan of Larry Clark or Harmony Korine. But
yeah, he's another one.
I get it. I get the appeal, because that was like the last time that films really seemed to be a movement of filmmakers being transgressive. Like, genuinely transgressive. You know, Kids is a genuinely transgummo. Doom Generation are all genuinely transgressive films. You know? And like I said, there's stuff they do there that, like I said, they would, you know, the mainstream would be like, ooh, their monocles would pop out. You know, and they'll never be, you know, there will be people who like them. They will have their audiences. They will have their... They're critical darlings, and they're people who are cinephiles or cineasts, however you want to take them, will like their stuff. And people like you and I will like, even if though I don't, people like you and I who are interested in transgression and bizarre and cult and genre will enjoy it. But they'll never be mainstream. They'll never get popular acclaim.
No.
They'll never be... No. You know, you're never going... Greg Araki will never make a Star Wars film.
I want to see Greg Araki make a...
to see that film so badly. You know, I feel robbed that we never got David Cronenberg or David Lynch's Return of the Jedi. You know?
I'm still holding out for the David Lynch... I'm holding out for the David Lynch Bond movie. You know, dream sequences... backward speaking bad guys and red rooms, it would be fantastic. And Bond would drink martinis, he'd muse over coffee and pie.
Yeah.
I mean
that makes about as much sense as Quentin Tarantino doing Star Trek.
Well, that's only because, I mean, we Tarantino, it's basically there was a buyer's market for it, and went to him and said, you can come to us and do anything you want, and he said, I want to do Star Trek. And they were like, sold.
Get me my phaser. It's the one that says bad motherfucker.
But I mean, speaking of new hip directors, I mean, I want to give a quick shout out to Bryony Stokes. Now, Bryony Stokes is a short filmmaker, and she's done a number of films about the environment. And in particular, she did a short film about my father called Mr. Flotsam. Now, this was directed and made shortly before my father passed away. He lost his battle with cancer. So when you watch it, he may look like he's auditioning to be the Crypt Keeper, but it's just because of the state he's in. And he did a Facebook group called Flotsam and Jetsam, and he did beach cleaning. He decided late in life he was going to go and study marine biology, and he actually came up with a method for taking slipper limpets out of its shell. And when he phoned up the university, he said the line went very quiet as somebody's grant died. So and basically he came up with this idea of showcasing how plastics get into the ocean by collecting bottle tops and stringing them all together. And you would be able to see this long chain, and it would be a representation of time. And the film itself is basically just an interview with my father, and he talks about what he was doing with the plastics, and talks about a little bit about his theories of why we need to obviously be preserving beaches. And it's as I said, it's just him giving his life philosophy. I mean, he was very passionate about cleaning beaches, and it comes across in the film as well as his like general sense of humor that he had. And I think it was just like a really fitting tribute to it. And I really want to say thank you to Bryony for putting it together, because I didn't know he'd done this until recently when it was released. My mum apparently knew. She had been given it, and she told me that it had gone on. So the first time I saw it is when it gets put on Vimeo. And I shared it, and I did give her a nod, but she hasn't got back to me on Twitter, so I guess, I don't know, she didn't check her Twitter or whatever, but I just wanted to give her a quick thanks, and, you know, just recommend people to watch it. I mean, it's only 7 minutes and 50 seconds, but it's hardly the biggest thing, but it's an interesting little think piece just on plastics in the ocean without it getting preachy. And I think it was just a real fitting tribute to, obviously, the work he put in and the other people who obviously do the beach cleanings in Cornwall and around the UK, obviously trying to preserve beaches and clear the oceans. And it's called Mr. Flotsam, and you can find it on Vimeo. I will actually put the link in the description below, and if you check it out yourself, and everyone let us know what you think, and leave us some comments.
I didn't realize that was going on, that they had when I watched that film, and they had kind of like the before and after, and just all that plastic junk just washes up on the shore. I didn't realize that was really kind of going on in Cornwall. And your father comes across as very, not very warm. I mean, he's very, very committed. He's very devoted to it, but he doesn't come across as preachy. It comes very warm, and I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
and just kind of getting this chance to kind of see, that one person can make a difference.
And it's I love the fact that when you go in his shed, it's an absolute tip, because that's what his shed was, and you actually get to see him when there's a shot of him meeting Prince Charles. It's only a little photograph in there, and of course it's when he's wearing that stupid hat. He meets a member of the royal family. It's not when he's like in his best suit or anything. It's when he's wearing that stupid sun hat. But yeah, I think it was it's really great. And it's, as I said, when you see the size of this chain from when they were collecting all these bottle tops and stuff, it's really quite astounding, and it's quite an interesting a good visual way of presenting what the issue is with plastics in the ocean. If you are environmentally sound or want to does know a bit more about Plastic in the Ocean, then Miss Flotsam on Vimeo. Definitely check it out. We will put the link below. Of course, we are on the ThatMomentInNow.com podcast network, so you will be able to listen back to every episode of this show on there, as our archive is being added to the podcast network. We are also on both Podomatic and iTunes, so if you haven't done already, please do hit the subscribe buttons and leave us some comments. It all helps. And, you know, why not let us know what's been holding your interest? We always love to know shows that you think we should be watching, and the shows which are generally holding the attention of everyone out there. But obviously that's been what's been holding our interest. And I think it's on that note, we'll move on to the first of our selections for this evening. And we're going to start with Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, if that's okay with you, Lucky.
Oh, let's do that.
Okay. Now, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place ties in perfectly with our other selection for this evening, Danger 5, in that both these shows are throwbacks to B-movies and sort of 1980s television, but they were both sort of done before it became sort of the in thing to sort of hype the style. I think you could argue, like, Grindhouse obviously was doing it as well with, like, adapting sort of the 1970s sort of Grindhouse sort of style with theirs. And with Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, it's a show that's presented as a lost TV series that was made in the 1980s, but the powers that be, as Garth puts it, thought it was too shocking and buried it. And now, as I was watching the series, is the first time this show's been shown on air, supposedly. Now, this was put out by Channel 4, and it was created by Richard Adeodi, who's probably best known for doing the IT Crowd, and, well, his directing work as well. I mean, he directed Submarine and the Double?
Am I right? The Double.
Yep. Yeah.
There was a Double with Jesse Eisenberg.
And here he created the show with Matthew Holness, who plays Garth Marenghi, who's kind of like this Clive Barker style character, who had apparently written more books than he's read and felt that he'd outgrown the format of the novel and felt that television was the way forward. The show itself is
I just love the character of Garth Marenghi, who is just he's so ignorant and so self-aggrandizing, and every episode he opens with reading stuff from his books, and it wasn't in this episode. I think it was in the fourth episode, but the one with the must be the worst sex scene ever written, where this guy, he took off in one depth movement, he took off her dress and her panties. Then they did it in all three positions, doggy style, on top, and regular. Then they were eaten by a hell beast. And it was just like, my God, how do you even? Oh my God, I lost it at that episode. I don't think that episode, anything else in that episode, I think just really kind of paled just in comparison to that sample of Garth Marenghi's writing.
Yeah, I mean, Garth Marenghi is played by Matthew Holness, who I think if you're a fan of The Office, the British version, we'll recognize him as he played the IT guy in one episode, and was like the greatest character in that whole show, to the point that whenever me and my brother get to go, we tend to quote his character, like, he's the IT guy, but he makes all these wild claims, such as the fact that he went to a go-kart track and the guy pulled him over and said, no pros, and he's like, oh, I'm not a pro. It's just like... that he was in a go-kart and he flipped over, did a 360 midair, landed on wheels, and he got out and was like, yeah, what's the problem? It was kind of like a forerunner for this character, because Marenghi is so convinced of his own genius that everything he writes is absolute gold. And he's surrounded at the same time by people who aren't particularly great actors, yet have convinced themselves that they can act. I mean, Richard Iodi plays... He plays this Black Dynamite-looking director.
Sorry.
Who, called Dean Lerner. Who, like Marenghi, believes himself to be the greatest director ever, but not a great actor. So whenever he does the acting, he says all his words in the same tone as quick as he can. This is a weird ass show.
Oh god, he's got the both lines. It's like, my ass is cross, and he has the lawnmower. It's just, he gets some of the absolute best lines. He just has this total flat delivery. Just of every, but I mean, everybody does on this. Like, everybody, I was just watching it. The whole thing is, and I know I'm taking stuff away from you, so forgive me, but just, I mean, it's like, at some points, it's like watching, like, an early 80s shot on video TV shows. At other times, it's like watching an Italian horror film from 75 where there's the mismatched dubbing and, like, just obvious frames missing. There's this great scene in this episode we did, the first episode, where the Foley, the sound effects of the footsteps don't... People sit down and the footsteps keep going.
Oh, yeah, and... I mean, it doesn't go back to Lerner. I mean, he has the in this first episode, he has the great line, I'm going to put my foot in the ass so hard that it makes a dent you can put a pool in it. It's like, oh, come on, this is awesome. And, I mean, if we were to compare this in modern terms, I think if you look at a film like Birdemic or The Room, that's basically what Garth Marenghi's Dark Place is. These get people convinced they're making the greatest show ever, but it's truly awful.
Yeah. This is a horror version, horror television of The Room, done by people who get the joke.
And, yeah, I mean, I love the fact that Marenghi is... He's so keen to add to his own hype for the show. I mean, he cites in one episode, he cites possible government suppression as the reason the show got cancelled by the MI8, which is actually three levels above MI6. And that they pulled the plug and they did it because they know the truth. So, and when you watch this, the genius of the setting of this, the fact that they use the old Channel 4 logo when the episode starts to tie in with that 1980s theme, so it does actually look like it was broadcast in the 1980s. But I mean, as you said already, like, you can see there's a scene where there's a cat that's supposed to appear for nowhere, but you can see the guy drop the cat into the frame.
And what I love about it is how Alice Lowe stops, bends over as if the cat's there to pet it, and then the guy throws the cat into frame.
Yeah, I think the weirdest thing, when Garth Marenghi was shown for the first time in the UK, at the same time Channel 2 was showing The Kingdom by
Lars von Trier.
But yeah, Lars von Trier. And when you watch The Kingdom, oh God, it's pretty much the same as Garth Marenghi's. You know, it's a hospital setting.
It's done for drama. You know, yeah. It's done for drama ostensibly. If you can imagine a woman giving birth to a fully grown Udo Kier as being dramatic, then by God, it's dramatic. It's not comedy at all. Anyway.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the whole thing. With Dark Place. I mean, it's all set in Dark Place Hospital, which, as we find in this episode, is the site of some very strange goings on because they accidentally opened a portal to hell in the basement.
In the canteen.
Yeah, sorry, they opened
it. It was in the canteen, in the cafeteria.
My God.
That's one does.
But as we see in this first episode, it's basically Marenghi's character, who he's playing a doctor called Dr. Rick Douglas, who is not only a Vietnam but also a Falklands War veteran and a former warlock, and keeps a Magnum revolver on him for no apparent reason. And his former best friend basically explodes from demonic possession. To which he responds, and he's at this point, I mean, he's been splattered worse than the exploded head in Scanners. And to which he responds, "Are you okay?" And he's just basically reduced to a screaming head on the floor.
But no, I love the commentary. I love the commentary because they put in commentary from the characters, not from the Dark Place characters, but from the characters that appear in the show. And you have Matthew Holness as Garth Marenghi commenting on that scene. "I have never exploded, but I know what it's like. Don't ask why. I've just always known what it's like." And then Dean Lerner is sitting there talking about how he thinks someone very close, like a lover or a pet, might have exploded, and it's always been with him. It's, dear God, "I have never exploded."
I mean, the whole reason I actually went to look back at this first one is just really when we get to the finale, where this recently exploded corpse somehow leaps out of the grave, fully formed, leading to a slow motion gun sequence, which doesn't seem to have been shot in any particular order, as we've got Richard Adeoda's character basically firing shotgun blasts at something, you don't know what. You've got Garth Marenghi in slow motion trying to shoot it with his magnum, only for the corpse's mother to get in the way, so he shoots her as well.
And the funniest thing in that sequence is that all this is happening in slow motion. You know, people are screaming in slow motion, and you have Matt Berry say at normal speed, "That's the mother." And I also want to point out when you cut between some of these scenes, you have Rick Daglis like shooting his magnum, and you have Dean Lerner behind him doing nothing. And then you'll cut to another scene where Dean Lerner, wearing a different coat in an obviously different location, firing the shotgun.
Oh yeah, I mean it gets weirder still. If you watch this with the commentary, they do it completely in character. But the only person who's not there is Alice Lowe, because her character's apparently been missing for years, so she's not on the commentary. But they do everything completely in character, so it's even more random still.
Oh God.
This is one of those shows which, it, like we saw with like the early 90s shows like Bottom and the Young Ones, they were bringing together all the sort of fringe comics of the era. And this is certainly does the same for like the 2000 comics. So in this, we've got Matthew Holness, we've got Richard Adeoda, Matt Berry. You've also got Stephen Merchant shows up in an episode, Julian Barrett, Noel Fielding.
Randomly.
Yeah, he turns up in the fourth episode.
He takes a wrath. Yeah, he plays the guy in the monkey suit.
Yeah, and if you follow the actors, you can see that they cross over with series. I mean, obviously Matthew Holness did a lot of work with Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant. He was in The Office.
Right.
He was in Extras. He was in Life is Short. He also appeared in IT Crowd.
And he did not appear in the IT Crowd. He did not appear. Holness did not appear apparently in either the Bush or the IT Crowd, according to Wikipedia.
No, Holness was in the live show for the Bush.
Okay,
he's the only one who never made it onto the TV show.
Yeah, so, they ended up replacing him with Rich Fulcher.
Yeah.
Obviously Richard Iowati and Matt Berry did the IT Crowd together. Alice Lowe and Richard Iowati were also on. And I think Holness was on Snuffbox. Which was the show that the short-lived show that Matt Berry did with Rich Fulcher, a couple of other people that showed up in the second episode, Graham Linehan, who created Father Ted, and IT Crowd and co-created Black Books. He's in there very, very briefly. That's kind of the sort of really the only. The only people you're missing is you're missing like part of like the spaced like a member like the Spaced group. You're missing like a Nick Frost or a Simon Pegg type from that, and that's the thing of just about all you're missing from that like group of British comic actors.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm just trying to link it in. I mean, you could go the long route round, and combine Brass Eye. Because the boss in the first season of
Chris Morris.
Yeah, he played the boss in the IT Renum. Crowd. Yeah.
Chris Morris played Renum, yeah.
Simon Pegg shows up in Brass Eye. He had a couple of cameo characters, as did the guy who played Brian the Artist.
Right.
So I mean you can go the very long route in winded route that way, just if you wanted to tie all the cross pollination together. But no, I mean this is I mean this was sort of hampered by the fact it was shown late at night, had very little advertising, and it's sort of gone on to become more of a cult following. And I think now that we're in this sort of mindset where we're trying to replicate things from the '80s and create intentionally bad films for whatever reason, that this seems all the more prominent now than it did perhaps when it was released. And certainly when you look at Danger 5, I think it's absolutely fantastic we've chosen to pair Danger 5 up with it, because it's really the closest show you can compare to being like it. Even though Danger 5, I would say, is more 70s than 80s.
Yeah. Dark Place was done in 2004, and that was, I think, that the Room was in production at that point. It might have been out, but I think the Room came out. I know it was an early 2000s type thing, but that was Dark Place came out before throwback horror became a thing. You know, that's 2004. That's 5 years before House of the Devil, which is the first film I tend to think of as being throwback horror.
Yeah.
I sort of separated from like the faux grindhouse stuff. Because it's the faux grindhouse stuff. It's got like the deliberate grainy things or the skipping frames or all that kind of stuff. Whereas the throwback, I tend to think of the hallmarks of the throwback are things like putting the copyright on the title card, the pulsing synth score, just kind of like the 70s hairdos, the women with the 70s hairdos, and, you know, 70s or 80s music on the soundtrack, and a little bit more of a filmic over video look, you know, but not so much, whereas I tend to think of the faux grindhouse thing as people that are trying to basically replicate the look of Planet Terror and Death Proof. But I can imagine, I know that Dark Place ran in the middle of the night. I can imagine people not knowing, understanding what it was that they were looking at. Because this was, I think, before the Bush started to get, the Bush have always been kind of like the sort of, weird thing that they've always been like a cult thing. But I mean, this was before the IT Crowd, several years before the IT Crowd, before Richard Iowati and, you know, before Richard Iowati and Matt Berry, which I think that was the thing that really kind of broke them out. They'd always been simmering. And certainly, I think, we have to do Snuffbox sometime. Snuffbox had come out before then, but Snuffbox was, again, something that not a whole lot of people had seen. You know, and Alice Lowe really only seems to be breaking out now. She did her film Sightseers a few years ago with Ben Wheatley, and then she just her recent film Prevenge, which I saw a year and a half ago at a film festival. She's only really seems to be getting a lot of popularity now, a lot of notice now. So it's like, but I just imagine people just scratching their heads and then having no context for what they were looking at, because it's obviously not serious. It's obviously comedic.
Yeah.
But it's you don't know. If you didn't know going into it what it was, I could very much believe somebody buying the idea that this was something from the 80s that had just never been shown before.
Oh yeah, it ties in with the whole idea of the real fake news. It's kind of like that Brass Eye effect, isn't it? It's sort of like you're presenting something as being real, but it's at the same time, it's too surreal and too weird to be real.
Right.
But at the same time, you don't want to question if it, in case it just about, it perhaps is. I mean, if you do like Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, there is a fantastic book by Grady Hendrix called Paperbacks from Hell, which is a history of 1780s horror fiction. And basically it looks like books that Garth Marenghi possibly would have written, so things like James Herbert's The Rats and Death Tour and The Nest and, you know, but just a lot of James Herbert.
James Herbert was pretty much a one-man paperback original churning out. He did a lot of that. He was an industry unto himself at the time. Him and Ramsey Campbell, who I always assumed Garth Marenghi's physical appearance was based on Ramsey Campbell. Ramsey Campbell had that sort of weirdly almost sort of like square shaped face, the big glasses, the longish hair combed straight back. That I always assumed that he was supposed to be Ramsey Campbell. With a little bit of Stephen King in there. Stephen King over here, Stephen King, particularly in the '80s. Was someone who, he was an author, you actually knew what they looked like.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't an actor, but he would show up in his own movies, you would know if you knew what to look for, but he would do like American Express commercials. And he did not shy away from doing publicity. So, that's the kind of thing that they're kind of getting at there. Okay. And Stephen King also wore those like stupid looking 80s glasses that Garth Marenghi wears.
I mean, Stephen King, I mean, he's almost, the man himself is almost iconic in his books. You kind of know who Stephen King is. And it's kind of weird. It's like, normally with authors, you don't have an idea what they look like. But Stephen King has always been this distinctive force. And he looks like, I think because he's lived such a low-key sort of lifestyle, when you find out some of the wild stuff that's plagued his career, like, when he was like addicted to cocaine and his wife dumped the bloody vials on his desk, and you think, God, this man was really out there at one point. And that was when he was writing good books. I mean, is there anything else you want to bring up about Garth Marenghi?
I think I've said just about all I wanted to say. Is this your favorite episode of the show?
It's the one I remember the most, and I think it's more for the ending. And it's been a while since I watched it, so it was kind of good in the fact that watching it now as an older viewer, because before when I watched it, I was a lot younger, and it's more on a visual level it was working for me. And now it's the subtle dialogues, and I think, obviously, watching more cult cinema, and as you said, you have the reference points for, like, in Italian cinema where it's all overdubbed.
Right.
And, like, the sound's not quite matching up. And just the dialogue or the performances, the way that Adioli acts his character, you pick up more as an older viewer than I perhaps did the first time around. But I love it. I love it. It's just still randomly weird. And I think it's the sides I like more than the actual main parts of the show. When Marenghi's adding to his own legacy, I think that's always my favorite part of the show. I think it's the start of the second episode where it's sort of like, created this awareness for you to enjoy from your chair or deck chair or perhaps your beanbag, whatever you choose to sit on.
You know, these sort of things that we'll throw in there, like, I'm a fan of the classics. Hamlet, Godfather, Jaws 2, you know? Just this. Just some of the random stuff we'll throw out there. It's like, I'm a serious writer. If I want to start an sentence with a full stop, I will.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back for another dose of randomness when we look at Danger 5 after the break.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at thatmomentin.com. I am your host, The Vern, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we're going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, Listen to the Cinema Recall podcast on the site thatmomentin.com or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy it.
And we're back. You, of course, are still listening to TV Good, Sleep Bad. In the first half, we looked at Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, and now we are on to our second selection this evening, which was from my good friend Lackey, and you chose to look at an episode of Danger 5, a show which, much like Garth Marenghi, it's came out and has slowly been gaining a cult following, especially amongst genre fans like ourselves, as it basically embodies all the things we love, but in a homage slash spoof kind of way. It's certainly a new one. I mean, this is a show which is shot like a 1980s B-movie. And it's in the style
really more like a 70s. I would actually say styled like a 70s.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
particularly in I think the choice of it, like the music is very late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
Like library music, and the music is actually a very, very important plot point in this particular episode. So go on.
But I mean, if you're not familiar with the show, it's basically follows the five international spies who form Danger 5, and they're on this constant mission to battle Adolf Hitler as he unleashes ever more outlandish and bizarre plans for world domination. At the same time, they are led by a half man, half eagle. And no one ever seems to even comment on the fact that they have got a man who's half man, half eagle.
Colonel Chestbridge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, the first episode I watched this, I saw the first episode, and I danced for Hitler. And in it, Hitler is basically going around and he's stealing world monuments. And at the same time, we have this dog, which is basically a bad-looking puppet. And there's a scene where they're in a club, and this dog's like comes on stage and it says "Zig Heil" and then walks off. And the guy falls on and goes, "Patriotic dog." And for some reason, I knew from that moment on I was going to love whatever the show did. And it's yet to fail to disappoint me, because it basically embodies all the things I love about genre cinema. But, I mean, what is it about Danger 5 that you love so much?
It's just so fucking ridiculous. It's just, you know, this whole thing where it's got these sub-Jerry Anderson production values. The first time I saw it, I was thinking, this is like the almost like UFO. This obvious model work. That was just the first episode. All this obvious model work. And just the like kind of like the format of the show, how they would always have the same things, and they would put it at the same point. Colonel Chestbridge shows up, and he's dressed like Patrick McGoohan in The Prisoner. You know, he's got the blue blazer with the white lapel, you know, trim, and he's got the turtleneck, and he says, "Well, your mission is to do that, and of course kill Hitler." The fact that the people that they cast as the various Nazis don't look anything like the actual people, historical figures. The little ads that they put at the end, the fact that at the end of every episode, someone, a dying character, has to give Pierre a recipe for a drink that is named after themselves. You know, just it's just so freaking bizarre. I mean, we watched the second episode of the show, which was called Lizard Soldiers of the Third Reich. And the basic thing here is that the British High Commander, whoever bosses MI5 around, whoever bosses, you know, Colonel Chestbridge around, the Nazis are have basically they are getting dinosaurs, no shit dinosaurs, to do their bidding by mind control. So the Danger 5 crew, they go to Belgium. I don't generally think rape is funny, But when you see, I'm gonna get killed for this. I know. Maybe I should just not say it. But there's a scene which is possibly the funniest scene I've ever seen in any comedy show where an anthropomorphic pterodactyl is not entirely consensual sex with someone, and I just lost it. And then it speaks in German. You know, it says blood, blood. You know, they have a stegosaurus and it's got machine guns mounted, tied to its horns, which is able to fire anyway. Anyway, our team, Trepid team, you know, and I mean, some of the you have these bizarre character archetypes. Like you have, you know, there are two Brits on Danger 5, and one of them, Tucker, the male, the man, he is so stiff upper lip. He reads a magazine called, what is it called? Sensible Chuckle Monthly. That's his idea of a humor magazine. And when Pierre, the lascivious Frenchman, is playing his bongo music, this obvious sort of nod to like 50s Martin Denny exotica with a scantily clad Hawaiian woman on the cover of the album cover type music, it puts him into a frenzy, and he says, if you ever play that music in front of me again, I will kill you. They go down, they trace this whole scheme down to Vandarctica, which is somehow a lost world type jungle.
Of course.
Because, of course. They meet Joseph Mengele, who kind of looks like Matt Lucas. They encounter a Santana type hippie rock and roll band made entirely up of ape men, and they say things like they get them involved in trying to take down Mengele, and they say things like, you know, yeah, we got to take this. We got to take this Mengele, could ya? We got to get him in the key of C major and drop him down to a B diminished, you know? And it's batshit insane. It's just absolutely batshit insane. Mengele is playing Dr. Moreau down in Antarctica, and he's coming up with lizard-human hybrids. So he captures some of the Danger 5 crew and makes them fight his hybrids, which are introduced in subtitles in Japanese, like they are sumo wrestlers or kaiju.
Well, I mean, let's not forget. I mean, these they basically look like the Koopa Troopas from the Super Mario Brothers movie. It's basically guys with giant dinosaur heads on them.
And there's no attempt to make them look like anything other than that. Yeah. I mean, these are Halloween costumes, and not good Halloween costumes. It's batshit insane. And there's really, I've never seen anything quite like it. I don't really have a frame of reference for it. And it's the same thing with Garth Marenghi. I have a frame of reference for Garth Marenghi, but in a very real way, it's not like anything I've ever seen before. And I don't think it's going to be like anything I ever see again on television. And no. Danger 5 is the same way. It's funny, but it's funny in a weird sort of way that everybody up there is playing it straight as if they're doing a drama. Just as in Dark Place. And this is everybody. Or they're not taking it. I don't know how to put it, but it's like there's this almost like this layer of sincerity to it. Like you can imagine the people making it were being honest about it, and it's just so bad that you have to laugh at it. But it's a sort of layer of comedy on comedy on comedy, which really kind of interests me. Yeah. In a way that most stuff that isn't deliberately bad, that is made to be deliberately bad, does. I don't really know how to explain it, but it really, there is, and it's so pulpy. It's so pulpy. It's so Doc Savage, and it's a lot of my sweet spots. I mean, just the with episode names like Hitler's Golden Murder Palace or Fresh Meat for Hitler's Sex Kitchen, Revenge of the Lizardmen, Back to the Fuhrer, stuff like that. It's insane, and it's creative, and it's it's not like anything that else that is out there.
No,
it's from the same people that did Italian. It's from the same people that did Italian Spider-Man.
You see, I never watched Italian Spider-Man. I only know Danger. Neither did I.
Until I saw an ad for it at an episode of it at Fantastic Fest.
Okay.
But yeah, no, it's just it's mental. It's completely mental. Let's see. I mean, I've cut you off a couple times, so you go and talk.
I just find Danger 5, I think it hits all those sort of sweet spots when it comes to, obviously, if you're a fan of cult and genre cinema, it hits a lot of those sweet spots. At the same time, this is a show where, even though the episodes are like 25 minutes long, I struggle to watch them in bulk. I can like watch one and then I have to go watch something else. I find them very, very filling. And I think it's because they're so rapid fire. And very, as you said, it's very pulpy. The structure of them. So while you obviously have all the fun aspects, you've got, like, as I said, you've got the Nazi dogs, you've got the dino soldiers, you've got the adverts for the Danger 5 play sets at the end of some of the episodes. It's the bits that come in between, where, especially with the character interactions, where it just gets a bit heavy. I mean, there's characters I really love, like Elsa, who's just constantly
smoking. Elsa's great. Yeah.
And then there's other characters like the bartender, who I just find very sort of draining, especially with the when we look at like the main characters. Like I said, we look at like Jackson and his interactions with like Tucker, and it's just like it just feels very stodgy in places, and I just kind of think, oh, can we not just get back to the Camp Hitler plot or like seeing some ropey looking special effects work or something like that. It's those moments that hold my interest rather than these attempts to replicate dialogue from the era or in the style of these things. So I don't know. It's hard to explain, but it's kind of like heavy metal in that way, in that as in the animated film or the comic book, not the genre music.
Right.
In that it's stupid and offensive, and you shouldn't like it, but for some reason you do. But it's very hard to explain why you like it to anyone else. It sort of works on that sort of subliminal level, really.
Right, you're going to get it or you're not going to get it.
Yeah,
it's definitely one or the other. It is just bizarre, and that is something that Heavy Metal the magazine and even the film did very well, this sort of cross-section and combining genres, like to take the sort of pulpy Edgar Rice Burroughs, Edgar Rice Burroughs Lost World type, Lost Continent type story, you know, and throw in Dr. Moreau stuff and throw in A Hunt for Nazis and then throw in, hippie protesters. You know, and then throw in this and then throw in that and then throw in a sumo ring and, you know, do this and do that. And it's just they make it an unholy mixture, but they make it work. You know, but yeah. It's something where you've got to be working on that kind of wavelength to begin with. You know, it's the cultiest. It's cult television in, I think, the strictest sense of the definition. You know, that you're a game, you're going to get Danger 5 or you're not. You know, it's going to be your type of thing or it's not. You know, and that to me, I think that kind of polarization is really, I think, kind of what makes, you know, that sort of thing, what makes each show what they are. The fact that they're not for everybody, but that when you find it, you think to yourself that you're not alone in the universe, because there is somebody else out there whose brain runs on the same wavelength that yours does, and that thinks, that there's something absolutely fucking hilarious you know, about a guy getting so excited by bongo music that he gets a nosebleed and threatens to kill one of his teammates. You know, that you're going to think that's funny or you're not. And it's the MST3K effect. You're going to, you know, I was watching one of the new MST3K episodes and they had this joke, which like, oh, only I get that joke. And it's, you know.
You see, I can't watch MST3K now because it seems to be what everyone writing in cult in like genre cinema seems to be emulating. And it's not with the love. It's sort of like, oh, look, I can be sarky about something. It's kind of like punching out an 8-year-old. It's like, yes, it's fun, but certainly nothing to make a career out of.
Oh, definitely it's fun. For me, at least. Not for the 8-year-old. But, it's no. You see, what a lot of people don't understand about MST3K is that MST3K was done with love and affection. A lot of people think that it's just, let's just make fun of something stupid. Let's just make some fun of something bad. And certainly, if you're a genre fan, a horror fan, a science fiction fan, there is a catharsis to be had in the thing of philosophy of let's rent a shitty movie and have some friends over and get some popcorn and make fun of it. But there was genuine affection on the part of the makers of MST3K. And actually, that is one of the reasons I learned to love movies like that, apart from their MST3K counterparts. You know, I always said that the perfect MST3K movie is a movie that you can enjoy without the riffing. Not because the riffing takes away, not because there's anything wrong with the riffing, but because there's a sort of entertainment value there that you've kind of learned to, you know, appreciate. You know, I want to see Star Blast now without the bot, you know, knowing the bots bits. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. I think it's just about, I think they believe, I think to an extent, and I think that's, I think to an extent that's, even I think Riff Tracks has kind of fallen prey to that, that it's just mean spirited and we're just going to take something and make, rip it apart, you know, without really having that affection for it.
Yeah.
And it's, you've had an entire generation of pop culture enthusiasts who have grown up on MST3K and believe that anything that you think is quote unquote bad, that's how you engage with it. And, I mean, I don't know. I'm probably just rambling on.
I think I can definitely see what you're saying then. I mean, I think certainly when we look at Danger 5, it's coming from that MST3K place, and same with Garth Marenghi, it's coming from that place of where you're taking the tropes of these things and amplifying them for a modern audience.
Right.
And I think that's where the humor lies. It's not, as I said, you said it's not about making fun so much. It's just about trying to shoot something serious, but using it under the restraints of that you've got to use these familiar tropes of the genre. And I think it's something that, it's this why I love things like Danger 5. It's the same reason I love like Kung Pao Into the Fist, because it's so lovingly plays up those kung fu tropes. So, but no, I think Danger 5. I think, as you said, Lucky, I think it's something you're ever going to love or get. Same as Garth Marenghi. I think you can't force someone to like it. I think they're either going to get it or they won't.
And that particular segment of British comedy is typified by that. That the same goes for Boosh. Boosh might even be very much same for Boosh, same for Snuffbox. It's a very particular strain of British comedy. It's very British, but it's even... It's so particular that I could see it, you know, going over Brits' heads, British people's heads, and people who are British kind of cocking their heads to the side and going, what? You know, even if they do like things like Monty Python or Spaced or what have you.
Yeah. I don't get the Boosh, so I'm one of those people. I never got its appeal at all. But, you know, that's just me. Maybe it's because I'm not a university student. They're the ones who seem to really love
that
the
Boosh. That could be.
Maybe. Right. So, I mean, that obviously brings us to the end of this episode. We hope you've obviously enjoyed it, and if this is your first experience of TV Good Sleep Bad, hopefully it's inspired you to go back and check out those our back catalogue, available now, as we said, through thatmomentin.com podcast network, which you can find at thatmomentin.com. We are also on Podomatic and iTunes, and generally where all good podcasts can be found. So wherever you happen to be listening to this, please make sure you hit that like button or subscribe, and let us know what you think. For the next episode, where would you like to go?
Well, the last three episodes in a row, I have picked comedy episodes. So I'm going to go in a different direction for this next episode. For the next episode, we're going to go with the first episode of what is nominally considered to be the third season of Aeon Flux.
Okay.
The groundbreaking quasi-anime thing that ran on MTV. So this is the one season that actually ran full-length episodes, or full 30-minute episodes. And the name of that episode is, I'm informed, Utopia or Deuteranoropia.
Okay, cool.
Basically, I bought the Aeon Flux DVD box set years ago and never watched any of the episodes, so this I need to correct that. So we're gonna crack that thing open finally.
Cool. For myself, I'm gonna go with one of those shows which it can basically be described as one of those loaded gun episodes, because when we obviously put the show together, there's certain shows that we knew we were going to cover at some point, and those are our loaded gun episodes. We know we put them on the table. We know that at one point one of us is going to pick up one of those guns and shoot the other one, and ruin their chances of picking it for themselves. And I think the time has come for me to pull one of those episodes, and I'm going to choose The Young Ones. And if only for the fact that this features a musical performance by Motörhead, who we recently lost the last surviving member of that great, fantastic group.
Filthy Phil.
Yes.
Or am I thinking of a character? Yeah, Phil, what's his name? Not Filthy Phil. Filthy Phil was a character on
Filthy Animal.
Sons of Anarchy. Filthy Animal, yeah.
Who apparently at one point was on so much drugs he fell off somebody else's shoulders, landed on his head, and was told that if he had not been on so many drugs, he would have broke his neck and died. Motörhead are one of my favorite groups of all time, and this was
the Ace of Spades.
This episode's time was also the first episode The Young Ones ever watched, and going into this, I mean, I watched Bottom, so first of all, I get Rick Mail. And I get, my pick next week, I'm going to choose The Young Ones, and we're going to go with the episode Bambi, if only for the fact that the musical guest is the one and only greatest musical band in the world. We, of course, are talking about Motörhead. We're going to watch Bambi, and we're going to watch The Young Ones, and we're going to just revel in the wonderful punk comedy of The Young Ones. This features so many of my favourite things. It features Ben Elton, it features Rick Mail, Aid Edmondson, and oh my god, it's just going to, if you thought this episode was anarchy, just wait until we get onto The Young Ones.
Oh god, this is the one, this is my favourite because it's the one with the University Challenge one with Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie and Emma Thompson and Ben Elton. And when, you know, this was a great thing to show people back in the late 2000s, I would show them clips from this episode on YouTube and I would go, that's Dr. Gregory House.
So next episode we will look at Aeon Flux, and we will also be looking at The Young Ones. Thank you, everyone, of course, for joining us this evening. Lucky, if people want to find you, where's the best place to go and find you?
LuckyOnFilm.com.
Okay. As for myself, as always, I can be found at fromthedepthsofhell.blogspot.co.uk, as well as at thatmomentin.com, writing the stuff for Game Warp. We've got the Movie Tourist series that is still ongoing. So lots of exciting things. If you haven't done already, also do check out the other great shows on the podcast network we've got on there. We've got Cinema Recall, which is with the Vern. We've got Game Warp, which is with Kim Lowe. And we've also got the Asian Cinema Film Club, which is, with myself and Stephen Palmer as we talk about Asian cinema. So, lots of good stuff on there. And we're, of course, always looking to expand. So if you have got a podcast and you feel that you would like to be part of the network, please do, check out the contact us section at thatmomentin.com and, see how you can contribute to this fantastic, platform that we are now proud to be a part of. But thank you again, everyone, for listening. And thank you, of course, to my co-host, Lucky, for joining me again.
Thank you.
But next time, as I said, it is going to be Aeon Flux and the Young Ones. So we hope you can join us. But until next time, remember to keep it strange.